Blog Talk Radio.
Oh, angels sent from up above, you know you make my world light up. When I was down, when I was hurt, you came to lift me up. Life is a dream.
From the Blog Talk Radio studio in the heart of Hudson County, folks. I know it's always in Union City. Insider and Jay proudly bring to you Politically Direct. And I am the professor, Fernando Uribe. I want to welcome you all here tonight, the 11th of April, 2019. And hopefully for many of you in New Jersey and around the area, you were able to enjoy WrestleMania week this past week, ladies and gentlemen, which culminated with WrestleMania 35 at MetLife Stadium. And, of course, there was a problem with New Jersey Transit, as thousands of noted WWE fans had to stand in the pouring rain waiting for more trains to arrive. But you know what? What else is new? Governor Murphy, do me a favor. Get this fixed, please. You know, riders and commuters alike suffer enough every day. You know, rates keep going up, and we're not getting the service that we deserve. So please, Governor Murphy and State Senate President Steve Sweeney and Assembly Speaker Craig Coughlin, let's get the ball rolling. And let's hold some of the clowns at New Jersey Transit accountable. You know what? It's long overdue that we need to improve this dreadful transit system here in New Jersey. Again, the most densely populated state in the country, and we have perhaps the most garbage transit system anywhere in the 50 states. So do me a favor, let's work on this. My heart goes out to all my fellow WWE fans. I was there at MetLife Stadium. I ended up paying $40 for parking, and it was a better deal for sure. Instead of waiting for the train. But you know, in any event, folks, we'll talk about that today. I do want to thank you for listening from wherever and however you may be doing so throughout the Garden State and, of course, throughout the good old U.S. of A. You can write to the show's inbox at any time, politicallydirectnj@yahoo.com. Once again, politicallydirectnj@yahoo.com. And don't forget to follow the show on Instagram @politicallydirectnj. You can also follow me directly on Instagram @ProfessorFernandoUribe. And, of course, check me out on Twitter @ProfessorFUribe, URIBE. And for all of you Facebook subscribers, take a moment. Please go to the official page for Politically Direct. Like it, of course. Share it on your walls and tell your friends to do the same. Now, I do want to hear from you tonight at some point, folks. Don't be shy and call me toll-free, 818-572-8032. Once again, toll-free number tonight, 818-572-8032. Our toll-free number is brought to you by Insider NJ. Now, don't forget to check out Insider NJ, ladies and gentlemen, by going to their website, www.insidernj.com, for the absolute best coverage of the entire political scene here in the state of New Jersey. Nobody does it better than Insider NJ. And once you go on the website, folks, click on the subscribe button at the very, very top, and you'll be automatically enrolled free of charge with the morning intelligence briefing. So when you wake up in the morning and you're drinking your morning coffee, maybe checking out the cable news shows, hopefully Fox and Friends and not some of the garbage on MSNBC or CNN, you know, or perhaps you're watching the sports debate shows in the morning. I personally like Fox Sports, and I like to listen to First Things First, and of course, then Undisputed, and then The Herd. But if you like to watch ESPN and some of the really mediocre programming such as Get Up, and then obviously, you know, First Take, hey, that's if that's your cup of tea, God bless you. But regardless of whatever you're doing at home, folks, when you're on your laptop, your notebook, your smartphone, tablet, whatever it is, you check your morning emails, and the morning intelligence briefing will be right there for you. Again, courtesy of Insider NJ. Don't forget to follow them on Twitter and, of course, like them on Facebook. Don't forget to start and end your day with Insider NJ. Now, the opinions and views expressed tonight here and every week on Politically Direct are mine and mine alone. They do not represent those of Insider NJ, management, the journalists, or the staff. Speaking of the management, I do want to send a shout-out and a very, very big happy birthday wish to my boss, the general manager of Insider NJ, Pete Oneglia. Pete, happy 30th birthday today. May you celebrate many, many more. I know I speak on behalf of everybody at Insider NJ. You're a great boss to work for. You tolerate me. You tolerate some of my stuff, and I appreciate that. But more importantly, it's about you today. So happy birthday. Enjoy, and best wishes now and always to you on this special day. So, Pete, if you're listening tonight, we hope you are eventually. I know you're very busy getting home from various meetings. I appreciate your faith in the show. Appreciate your support of Politically Direct. And, again, I want to wish you a very happy birthday. And here's to many more. To one of the better bosses I've ever worked for in my lifetime. So, again, shout out to Pete Oneglia, the general manager at Insider NJ, on his birthday today. Well, folks, again, toll-free number tonight, 818-572-8032. Once again, toll-free number tonight, 818-572-8032. We have a great guest coming up in just a few minutes, so you want to stick around for that. Folks, again, if you're just tuning in here on www.insidernj.com/podcast, don't go anywhere. A wonderful guest coming up in just a few minutes. But it got me thinking, folks, as I start off at the onset here, got me thinking about how poorly run New Jersey Transit is. And it just, you know, when I saw what happened this past Sunday at MetLife Stadium during WrestleMania 35, it reminded me how New Jersey Transit really needs to get their act together. And that's the subject of my first shot. Folks, again, if you weren't aware, you know, big professional wrestling fans like myself converged on MetLife Stadium this past Sunday for the 35th edition of WrestleMania, which is indeed the Super Bowl of professional wrestling. So, hey, don't judge me, laugh at me all you want, but I'm sure if you watch soap operas or you watch The Kardashians or you watch a lot of reality TV, whether it's The Bachelor, Dancing with the Stars, whatever it is, hey, if you watch that stuff, don't judge me for watching pro wrestling. It's entertainment, it's an escape for me, and I find it quite enjoyable. But folks, what wasn't enjoyable on Sunday were the thousands of people that were stuck waiting in the pouring rain and cold after New Jersey Transit really messed up on Sunday. And leave it to New Jersey Transit official folks to blame World Wrestling Entertainment and not take responsibility themselves. I mean, is anyone surprised by that? I'm not. And let's be honest, the piss poor management at NJ Transit, really, I think, when you see the inefficiency and the incompetency and the inadequacy of what happened on Sunday, it just reminds you of all the work that needs to be done with New Jersey Transit. Now, every news outlet really locally, you know, talked about this. And what bothered me, and this is, you know, a quote from a press release from Jim Smith, the New Jersey Transit spokesman. He went on to say, quote, "The primary factor contributing to the post-event delays was the WWE's decision to extend the event to 12:30 a.m. which had significant operational impacts on the evening. New Jersey Transit was not informed of the decision until late last night." Folks, that's absolute nonsense, okay? Also, what was interesting was, you know, now this is Matthew Altman, a spokesman for WWE, said in their own statement right afterwards, quote, "We regret any inconveniences fans may have experienced with mass transportation after the event." Altman said that the WWE doesn't advertise its events end times, just like other sports and entertainment events, and that it did not receive any kind of fine. Folks, this is the thing. And even Governor Murphy felt the need to chime in on this because he was at the wrestling event for about the first 90 minutes in the governor's box, which is there for, you know, every sitting governor at MetLife Stadium. And he said he believes that New Jersey Transit is, quote, accurate in saying that the event ran later than the agency was told. You know, and this is one of the conflicts that exists here. I mean, there's no direct service between MetLife Stadium and, let's say, Penn Station, New York. So people trying to leave the stadium had to take trains to either Secaucus Junction and then transfer to the New York-bound trains that were operating hourly starting at 3:48 p.m., according to the advisory from New Jersey Transit. Folks, listen, this is where New Jersey Transit drives me crazy. You know, it's up to you to find out and make sure that riders are being accommodated. To just simply blame WWE and say, well, the event ran longer than expected. No, there's no end time when it comes to WWE. Now, yes, WrestleMania is the longest event of the year. It started at 5 p.m. with their pre-show. It lasted, and it was there, roughly until about 12:40 a.m., culminating in the main event win by Becky Lynch, defeating both Charlotte Flair and former UFC star Ronda Rousey to win the winner-take-all match and win both the Raw Women's Championship and the SmackDown Live Women's Championship. So it was certainly a very joyous occasion, despite the fact that it started getting a little chilly at night. But the problem is the pouring rain that started about 1 in the morning. And I remember because as I was driving home, obviously I was stuck in the rain, driving on Route 3, trying to get home after that. But folks, what bothers me about New Jersey Transit is just like their lack of accountability and their unwillingness to take responsibility. Like, it just seems like pass the buck and that's what you want to do. That's not what the state's transit system should be doing to its commuters, to its riders, who pay enormous amount of money in monthly passes and train tickets and everything else. So to just simply pass the buck and blame WWE for what happened on Sunday, I think is preposterous. It is just outrageous, and I think it's downright ridiculous. So you know what? Big thumbs down, New Jersey Transit. You know, you should have more respect for New Jersey residents who pay your salaries, by the way. And the fact that you chose to sort of be cavalier about this really says more about you than WWE. So shame on you, New Jersey Transit. Please get your act together, okay? We've been begging you to do this, and we're hoping that Governor Murphy really puts his foot on your throats for this, because you've been inefficient for far too long. My heart goes out to all my fellow WWE fans who were stuck in the pouring rain on Sunday going into Monday morning after the conclusion of WrestleMania 35. So between now and the immediate future, I'm hoping that Governor Murphy, State Senate President Steve Sweeney, and Assembly Speaker Coughlin take all of their 6 feet collectively, excuse me, 9 feet collectively, excuse me, I'm sorry, 6 feet, yeah, sorry, it's late in the day, 6 feet collectively and put it down the throats of New Jersey Transit. It's a disgrace. You guys in Jersey Transit should know better. Passing the buck, I know it's what you like to do, but do me a favor. You need to stop doing it because no one's buying it. And I really feel bad for everybody that had to endure that on Sunday. And I feel bad for everybody in New Jersey that has to endure the piss-poor administration of New Jersey Transit. And I hope you learn your lesson after this, because all the negative press you've been getting is rightfully deserved. That's the first shot here tonight, Politically Direct. Folks, 8-5-7-2-8-0-3-2, the toll-free number tonight to call in. Love to hear from you later in the show. We'll take some calls, certainly. But we have a lot to talk about tonight. And folks, without question, this is a guest I've been looking forward to for a very long time. I've been watching their organization. I've been checking out their site, www.maketheroadnewjersey.org. A lot to talk about. And joining me now, here live on Blog Talk Radio, is the director of Make the Road New Jersey, and I hope I get her name right, the great Sarah Kalanani joins us here on Politically Direct. Sarah, welcome.
Hi, how are you? Thanks so much for having me.
Listen, the pleasure's of mine, Sarah. Now, first of all, did I get your name correct? Because sometimes I do botch that for my guests. I apologize.
You were so close, Kalanani, but yes.
Kalanani, okay. I'll remember that as I have various clothes throughout the year. Sarah, how are you there?
I'm doing well. I'm sorry to hear about your ordeal on Sunday.
Well, I mean, listen, I paid the $40 and parked, but I know many wrestling fans that had to endure that on Sunday. And really, it's a microcosm of the incompetence and inefficiency that is New Jersey government and New Jersey agency. So, and we'll get to that in a little bit, Sarah. I could certainly be the town on the state of New Jersey for hours here. But you were a guest that I've been very much looking forward to, Sarah. And one of the things that interests me about your organization, and listen, I'm the son of immigrants, and I know firsthand as a first-generation American the struggles of immigrants. My parents respectively left the communism in Cuba and sort of, you know, pretty bare economic conditions in Colombia respectively. They came here. And, you know, watching my parents grow up as I did in a very heavy immigrant community up here in Hudson County, you know, I really got to firsthand appreciate the struggles of immigrants, really what they go through. And I always respect the work ethic of immigrants because my parents instill that in me in a long time. But, Sarah, we're living in a climate now, I think, is that, you know, the way we look at immigration reform is a very polarizing topic. Before we even get into some of the rhetoric that's out there and sort of, you know, what the organization represents, for our listeners that are tuning in tonight for the very first time, tell us as concisely as you can the mission statement of Make the Road New Jersey and what drew you to work for this organization, Sarah.
Sure, and thank you again for the opportunity to join the show. Make the Road New Jersey builds the power of immigrant and working class communities here in New Jersey to achieve dignity and respect. And we do that mainly through community organizing. We also provide legal services and education and policy work. And every week, hundreds of immigrant families join committees in our organization where they decide on campaigns that they're going to work on, from expanding access to driver's licenses in New Jersey to raising the minimum wage and fighting against wage theft to stopping banks from financing private detention centers. What drew me to this work is that the state of immigration and immigration law, our immigration system in the United States is broken, and you know, New Jersey is a state of immigrants. There are 2 million foreign-born people here in New Jersey. Immigrants are contributing $4.4 billion to our economy, and yet we have a federal government that prefers to separate families, put children in cages, and really strip people of their basic rights. At our organization, immigrant community members have joined as members, and they determine the fights that they want to take on, and we've been able to make a lot of progress. So what inspires me every day are families who are facing deportation, poor conditions at their workplace, discrimination, who are really coming together to fight back not only for their own rights, but to build a stronger state for everyone.
Wow. Okay. That's a lot to dissect there. And I appreciate you being specific, Sarah. And, you know, one of the things I take pride in here on this program is not just, you know, my day job as an educator, but really trying to get to the heart of, and, you know, trying to be an object journalist here or even a commentator. You know, there's a lot in there that we can sort of, you know, unravel here and to really dissect, I think, individually. And one thing that really caught my eye about your narrative right now and sort of, you know, the language we see, especially in today's political climate, is how we look at foreign-born individuals in New Jersey. And one of the things that I think becomes difficult, Sarah, and, you know, tell me if I'm wrong or maybe if you see it my way as well, I think context is important, and I think also sort of even the word usage, I think, becomes critical. And one of the things that becomes challenging here, Sarah, is the idea that, you know, depending on which side of the aisle you sit on ideologically, you know, some might say, I'll sort of give you an example. I mean, my parents have been here for over 50 years, and, you know, they came illegally many decades ago. And listen, you know, my parents are two individuals who are over the age of 60. One's over the age of 60, one's over the age of 70. And, you know, they understand the struggles of immigrants because they were immigrants themselves. And they understand the necessity of being compassionate and being humane. But there are people like my parents and maybe a lot of individuals in their age demographics sometimes get flustered with what some would call semantics. You know, the idea of, well, you know, should we call people illegals, or should we call people undocumented immigrants, or should we call them undocumented persons? And I think sometimes, Sarah, there's that fine line that gets sort of conflated in the sense that, you know, what's the right context to use? What's the right verbiage to use? Because at the end of the day, you know, someone like my parents will say, you know what, we understand the concerns from a humanitarian perspective. We understand the necessities that immigrants do need as they arrive here. But someone like my parents, Sarah, will be the first one to turn and say, can we stop with the semantics? Like, if you're here illegally, you're illegal. You're not undocumented. You're not this or that. And I think sometimes that when that narrative is put out there, it's seen as bigoted or racist or xenophobic. And I can tell you, for example, that my parents are not racist. My parents are not xenophobic, and they're not bigoted whatsoever. However, it seems like in today's political climate, though, Sarah, you know, we're losing the capacity to be civil. And if we can't have honest dialogue sometimes about words, I think we're losing the battle here. I just want to get your thoughts on this narrative I just shared with you.
Thank you. I mean, I think you're absolutely right. The level of discourse in our country and the words that we use to describe immigration are intensely loaded. When we have a president who uses the word illegal and has, you know, incredibly racist views about immigration and really, you know, minces no words about talking about who he would prefer to see in this country and who he would prefer to see deported, we know that the terms illegal or undocumented can become incredibly charged. I think that, you know, we're facing an immigration system that is incredibly different from the one that your parents faced 50 years ago. 50 years ago, there was a system to come to this country. You could petition for your family members. You could come here and get a visa. Right now, you know, many of our members have been here for 20 years without papers. And a lot of people might say, well, why didn't, you know, why haven't you tried to get legal, or why haven't you tried to become a citizen? And I can tell you, you know, from talking to them every day that, you know, they've done everything they possibly can. They've paid thousands of dollars to lawyers. They have, you know, tried every single possible avenue to get status, but really our laws are designed and our system is broken such that people who are here working, have family here, really are, you know, consider the United States home, really have no viable legal option. And that's been the case since 1996, since Clinton was president. What we see today is an administration that not only will not create a viable pathway to citizenship for people who've been here, who call this country home, but is also intent on detaining and deporting people without regard to their situation. So I agree with you. I think, you know, it's just to come back to your question about terminology, I mean, I think the, you know, word illegal right now, I think to our, you know, our members would sound like a slur in many situations because of the way the dialogue has been polarized and because of the way that our, you know, president and others have really tried to, you know, attack communities and use words and obviously actions to attack.
Well, let me ask you this, Sarah, because what I think one of the dynamics when we're talking about immigration reform, and let's be honest here, I think that there's also sort of a intellectual dishonesty, I think, by, let's say, the media in the way that this is covered. I mean, for example, you can tell me, because I know obviously I do this for a living, so clearly you have much more access to data. I'm just sort of going by recollection, but listen, I understand that presently 45th president at times, you know, may use rhetoric that is very polarizing and charging. But one of the things that sort of escapes us, I think, Sarah, and you mentioned obviously going back to the Clinton administration in the 90s and then certainly so forth, you know, after, you know, his successor with George W. Bush and then Barack Obama. But it seems, though, that even – Sarah, it would seem that this problem about immigration reform or the way we sort of look at immigration in general – I think sort of precedes the current president. I mean, for example, I mean, I could be wrong, but, you know, the 8 years of Barack Obama, I mean, there was a significant amount of deportations, more so, and I could be wrong, tell me, you can correct me, because I like to learn new data, but the 44th president deported about as more than his predecessors combined. And I think I read that somewhere. And it seems like the media, let's be honest, liberal media, never took Barack Obama to task on this, because he deported, I would say, at least according to what I saw, more than George W. Bush did, and I think even more than Bill Clinton. And it seems like maybe the former president doesn't get the grief that he should, whether it's from journalists or scholars or advocates. And it seems like the current, again, there are some that would argue the current president seems to be getting a lot of flack when his predecessor deported more people in those 8 years that he was, you know, in the White House. I mean, are those facts inaccurate on my part, or is there more layers to this, do you think?
You know, you're not wrong. The Obama administration, in an attempt to create the sort of groundwork, what I think is a misguided groundwork to pass immigration reform, created an incredibly robust deportation system that did deport more people than his predecessors. That didn't go unnoticed. He was famously called the deporter-in-chief by immigrant rights activists, by leaders of some of the largest Latino organizations in the country. But what the Trump administration has done is really taken the infrastructure developed by the Obama administration. And I should say that under Obama, there were plenty of avenues for relief. Every ICE attorney, every government immigration attorney had discretion not to deport an individual if they'd been in this country a long time, if they had paid taxes, if they had family here. And they also, you know, Obama also created the DACA program, which helped individuals who come here as children and had gone to school to get relief from deportation. So it wasn't all deportations, but you're absolutely right that there were many. What I will say is that the Trump administration has drastically altered the immigration landscape by stripping away all of the protections that the Obama administration afforded, whether it was through prosecutorial discretion, creating the DACA program, creating robust asylum systems. And what the Trump administration has done is pivot towards even more intense enforcement. So, for example, here in New Jersey, in the first year of Trump's administration, we had a 42% increase in ICE arrests. That meant that immigrants and even U.S. citizens were being detained while they were dropping their kids off at school, while they were seeking justice in the courts, and at home in pre-dawn raids. So what Trump has done effectively is created an incredible intensification of what has already been a broken immigration system, where there were 11 million people who had not been able to get status, and has attempted to detain and deport millions more. So I think, yes, the characterization of the Obama administration as an escalation of deportations is absolutely right, and that has to be recognized. We can't put this current administration in the same boat. It has created policies that are absolutely designed both, you know, in states like New Jersey to terrorize communities, and then on the border to really undo decades-old asylum laws, basic foundations for our country, principles that our country was founded on, and that's had devastating effects.
Listen, and we'll certainly get to that. And folks, if you're just joining us right now, it's 8:25 here on the East Coast, here on Blog Talk Radio, the director of Make the Road New Jersey, a nonprofit 501c3 activist group here in New Jersey. You can check them out at www.maketheroadnj.org. And joining me here tonight is the director, Sarah Kalanini. Did I get it right this time, or did I still mess it up, Sarah?
So close. Cullinane.
You know what? I'm going to get it by the end of the show. My apologies. Now, Sarah, one of the things that, and we'll get to sort of more of a federal conversation about immigration reform, because I know that it's a big part of what Make the Road New Jersey is about, but, you know, other issues, even now in Jersey-wise, and let's take it within the borders of the Garden State, Governor Murphy clearly in his first 16 to 17 months in office has made it a priority to address the concerns of those that are, illegal immigrants / undocumented residents. And we know that for his base, that's certainly a narrative that helped get him elected. And certainly there are those in New Jersey that look at the governor and look at some of this rhetoric and some of the directives he's ordered upon Attorney General Gobeir Grewal, respectively, to perhaps maybe not be in the best interest of the state. Depends who you talk to. Ideologically, you might get different opinions from different people. One thing that the governor has certainly come under some fire for is the idea, and you can, again, clarify this for me, is the idea of, you know, he's directed the Attorney General to, you know, issue mandates as to how local law enforcement throughout the state and every municipality, how they are to interact with ICE or a lack thereof with ICE, for example. We know that it's come under some scrutiny. Some New Jerseyans argue that it's interfering with federal law. some would argue that it's compassionate directive by the governor. I think it's a safe bet. I know what position you take on this, but what specifically governs the thought process with Make the Rule New Jersey in terms of some of the mandates you've seen thus far in the Murphy administration?
So I'm so glad that you raised the Immigrant Trust Directive, which is the Attorney General directive that actually just went into effect on March 15th. I think it's a very important step that the Murphy administration has taken, that Attorney General Gurbir Graywal has taken, to both restore trust in law enforcement and also create a safer state for everyone. I think we're all safer when we know that our immigrant neighbors, our family, can go to the police and not fear being detained or deported or asked their status. So, you know, at Make the Road, this issue has been core to our membership. About a month after Trump was, inaugurated, one of our members, ICE came to her store in downtown Elizabeth. She was there with her baby and her older daughter, who was, a teenager, and ICE started beating on the door. They showed her a document. Fortunately, she'd been through one of our Know Your Rights trainings, so she knew that it actually wasn't a warrant, but they said, open the door, open the door, open the door. She had had a prior immigration case, and ICE was looking for her. She's also the victim of domestic violence. So she actually knew her rights and didn't open the door, but when ICE couldn't get this woman to open the door for them, they called the Elizabeth police to come in and for assistance, and the Elizabeth police came. And word got out that the Elizabeth police had been helping ICE in this situation, and the community became terrified. We saw parents pull their kids out of school. People were fearing reporting crimes, going to court. People didn't want to, report a violation of a restraining order against an abusive spouse. It was like nothing I'd seen before. And this is happening across the state. I met a man who had gone in to renew his business license in a town in Monmouth County. His fingerprints were taken to renew his license and at the local police station as a routine part of this licensing process. And the police officer noticed that he had a prior immigration order and called ICE and had the man come back in the next day under a false pretense to meet with ICE, and he was then put in deportation proceedings. This is a man who's been here for 12 years, has two kids, and, was a business owner. Another situation, a woman in Union County had called the police to report domestic violence. They ended up arresting both her and her partner. And she was transferred immediately into ICE custody after a detainer was lodged on her and is currently facing deportation. We've seen Dreamers deported over a marijuana arrest that happened late last year. So what this directive does is really end the collaboration and the use of New Jersey taxpayer dollars and New Jersey law enforcement to serve the Trump administration's plans of and program of mass deportation. So it does several things. It's a very comprehensive directive. But first, it requires that local law enforcement not assist in any immigration enforcement activities. That means not asking individuals their immigration status and not stopping or arresting them solely based on the fact that they think they might be a non-citizen. It also prohibits law enforcement from informing immigration of an individual's status. And there are some exceptions when a person is charged with a very serious crime. And then it does a few other things that I think really help to restore trust in the police in addition. So one of the only ways that an undocumented person can get status in the United States, one of the last remaining ways, is if you're a victim of a crime or of trafficking, you can go to your law enforcement. And if you've been helpful in prosecuting a crime or in investigating a crime, you can request what's called a URT visa. And so this directive now requires each police department, prosecutor's office, every law enforcement agency in the state to create those protocols. So this, you know, this directive is really created to, it was created to both protect immigrant communities, but also to protect all of our safety by ensuring that our law enforcement is not being co-opted by federal law. You know, a lot of people say, oh, well, this is going against federal law. You're, you know, disregarding federal agents. But actually, when New Jersey doesn't use its dollars to aid ICE, we're actually protecting constitutional rights of our residents, of all residents. You know, ICE arrested more than 1,000 U.S. citizens over the past couple of years. We know they sometimes make wrongful arrests. And so we have to, you know, we have to really put our values and, you know, we have to think about what our values are as a state in terms of how we protect people.
You know what, that's a very interesting observation, Sarah, and I'm glad you made it, because I think that it sort of helps me segue into my next question here, because I think one of the challenges we face here with this topic in New Jersey is on a couple of fronts. Number one, I think there would be some New Jersey that would very much argue, as you have, you know, invoking humanitarian values, invoking to some extent the idea that shouldn't be used for this, for example, right? So you raise a lot of points with that. Sarah, the problem, though, is, for example, and I'm sure you've heard this a lot, and whether it's on social media, whether you've heard it at workshops or town halls or symposiums or even, you know, board meetings, however it is you've been in the presence of. But there are some New Jerseyans, for example, and again, I'll delve back to my parents, you know, and those that sit within the age demographic, right? Let's say immigrants, you know, over 60, for example, that have been here for some time, they'll turn around and say, because I remember even having this conversation with my dad and others, you know, around the same age demographic as them, and they'd say to me, what's Governor Murphy doing? Last year in the state budget, he allocates $2 million during fiscal year, I think 2019, to create a legal fund to, you know, help provide for those here illegally. It's alleged, again, I don't know the exact number, it's being proposed that for the fiscal year 2020 budget, which is now in deliberations, then an additional million might be inserted into that same legal fund. My dad turned around to me, Sarah, and said, wait a minute, why are my tax dollars paying for this? Aren't there law clinics, aren't there nonprofits that provide legal representation for illegals? Well, let them worry about it. Why should my tax dollars be paying for this? And you know what, Sarah? The problem is that, again, that doesn't make them racist. It doesn't make them bigoted. It doesn't make them xenophobic. I think it makes them concerned like any other taxpayer, because I think there's a very real legitimate gripe by a lot of New Jersey. I would say, wait a minute. There are resources out there that provide this, whether it's legal representation or other resources. Let these nonprofits, who perhaps maybe are beneficiaries of grants, maybe they have excellent fundraising totals, you know, a variety of different things. But some might just turn around and say, why is the governor bending over backwards for them? Why not help taxpayers? Why not help Americans? Why not help citizens? When you hear that narrative, Sarah, aside from the fact that it's, you know, probably infuriating, how do you feel when you hear that from someone, let's say, who, again, been here 50 years, you know, is a taxpayer, is a citizen, whatever, they see this sort of policy initiative by the governor, and it drives them crazy. How do you answer people like that? Because I'm sure you've heard this.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. It is something we hear often, and I think you know, I think a few things. One, due process is so important. That is a bedrock principle that our country was founded on, and in New Jersey, yes, we have great nonprofit legal service providers, but before the Murphy administration allocated those funds, only one in three detained New Jerseyans, including, you know, this is not just undocumented people, this is actually mainly green card holders and often asylees, a handful of U.S. citizens. Everyone that was detained in New Jersey, only one in three of those individuals detained by immigration had a lawyer. So the nonprofit community just could not meet the huge need for legal defense. When individuals are detained by immigration and face deportation, the government is always represented by a lawyer, but the vast majority of individuals detained in New Jersey were not. So that's just, you know, if you're, for a criminal proceeding, you get a lawyer if you can't afford one, right? It's guaranteed by the Constitution.
Yes.
Same right doesn't apply in immigration court proceedings. So that's one thing. You know, this is about fairness. This is about everyone having their day in court. And so what that funding did was help, you know, not, it doesn't cover everyone, but it helps really meet that gap in fairness and due process. That's one. On the amount that was spent, you know, in the first year, it was $2.1 million. Well, immigrants in New Jersey, undocumented immigrants, contribute $600 million every year in taxes and state and local taxes by paying taxes, by paying sales tax, property tax. So it's not true that immigrants are takers or not, you know, contributing to our economy. $2 million is, you know, pales in comparison to what the undocumented pay. And then on top of that, when immigrants are detained, the state actually loses money. The state is employers pay millions of dollars in turnover costs. Kids get put in foster care and, you know, don't have a parent. There are lost wages and lost tax revenue. You know, there's more than 2,000 individuals are detained by immigration in New Jersey every year. And so that actually has a real cost. So I think we just have to really shift the narrative about how we're talking about this program. This is about keeping families together. This is about fairness and due process. And it's also about making sure that people are not being wrongfully detained, that people can be back in their communities contributing to the economy and with their families. So I think, you know, there's often a lot of spin about, oh, look, these are favors. Oh, look, these are, you know, special programs. But really, if you look at the level of representation of people who are detained, it's minuscule. Like, most people are fighting this huge uphill battle on their own when the consequences are so grave. It's, you know, detention, deportation, banishment, never seeing your family again, being returned to a country where you may face death or persecution. And so I think, this is about what are our values as a state. Are we about keeping families together? Are we about due process? Are we about fairness? Or, you know, are we going to go with the Trump administration and, be part of their program to separate people and keep them in cages?
Now, you mentioned the due process. And, Sarah, again, and just to be clear to our listeners, to maybe they're not familiar with the sort of the procedural dynamics of this, obviously, and before I worked in academia, I worked in state agencies, and I specifically when I was working at the public defender's office in Essex County, I mean, I fully know and understand the premise of legal representation. Certainly, tax dollars go into paying for the public defender's office. So certainly, individuals in New Jersey, regardless of their socioeconomic status, have access to legal counsel, again, under the Sixth Amendment, and certainly because of the Office of the Public Defender. Now, you mentioned that, again, when it comes to deportation proceedings, they're very different than, let's say, a criminal adjudication, right? So, I mean, I just want to be clear to our listeners that maybe aren't aware. So, having said that, if someone turns around and says, well, yes, we're talking about constitutional rights and due process and representation, but if someone turns around, and again, I'm trying to sort of ask these questions, and I think a lot of our listeners aren't aware of procedurally how this works, but if someone were to turn around and say to you, well, Sarah, they're not citizens, so how does our most sacred document apply to the individuals who are here illegally? Does due process still apply to these individuals? And, like, are there court precedents that establish this? You see what I'm saying? I mean, I hate to make this sound
formal. Yeah, no, it's a great question.
But it's important.
Yeah.
It's important to outline this for me.
So
if you could shed some light on this, please.
Yeah, I mean, I guess just first off, yes, the Constitution applies to people, all people, due process applies to all people, not just citizens. And so the answer is yes, it should apply to people who are undocumented or non-citizens. The other thing I'll just say is that, you know, U.S. citizens get detained by ICE and put in deportation proceedings, wrongfully so. And actually, one of the most important cases on detainers and immigrants being detained came from a U.S. citizen from Perth Amboy who was wrongfully detained in Pennsylvania, and he was held in a jail for 30 days until he could prove his U.S. citizenship. And, you know, the local jail got, you know, sued and ended up having to pay tens of thousands of dollars for wrongfully detaining him, which is an example of how our local governments, you know, not ICE, suffer when ICE, you know, makes this horrible mistake. So I would say also just, you know, we all should have the benefit of having a lawyer or an opportunity to have a lawyer when we're facing something as severe as deportation and, you know, really banishment. And that should apply to everyone across the board, and it does.
Sorry to be clear, and not to cut you off, I apologize, but to be clear,
no,
because, you know, are they allotted this sort of due process? Because I know you said before they should, based on precedent. Again, I'm asking you because I think it's important to sort of inform our audience, but, you know, are based on precedent, are they allowed due process even though that they're not here, even though they're here illegally? Have the courts ruled
yes.
on this?
Yes. Yeah, so So anyone who's in immigration court proceedings has the right to a lawyer, but if they can't afford one, they don't have the right to have one appointed to them like you do in criminal court. And I should just say that, like, in criminal court, you know, you have the right to an attorney and a, you know, that you have the right to a court, the court appointing you an attorney if you can't afford one, if you're a citizen or a non-citizen. It's just in the immigration court proceedings that you don't, that the state doesn't have to pay for one for you. You have to have the opportunity to get your own, but the state doesn't have to pay for it. So what the Murphy administration was trying to do is take a small step to increase the number of attorneys. And these are the same nonprofit legal service providers that are, you know, providing these services, that are, you know, recipients of the funding from the state.
Okay. And I'm glad you outlined this for me and for our listeners, because I think what ends up happening a lot, Sarah, with this discussion is the fact that if this information isn't put out there, there's a lot of ambiguity. And I think this is what really makes this topic so conflictive for everybody. Again, on both sides of the aisle. So I appreciate it. And folks, again, if you're just joining us right now, it is 8:45 on the East Coast here on Blog Talk Radio. It's my pleasure to have here on the show, still with me, the director of Make the Road New Jersey, Sarah Cullinane, here on Blog Talk Radio. How was that? Was third time a charm?
Well done. Perfect.
All right. Well, the professor gets it right eventually, you know, as I try. Now, Sarah, you know, and I appreciate you outlining this for me, but it sort of still begs a bigger question here. And the idea, and we'll get back to sort of the national conversation about this, but here in New Jersey, it would seem that whether it is the directive that Attorney General Grewal has issued, or the mandate, excuse me, that he issued to law enforcement throughout the state, and certainly Governor Murphy's you know, policy initiatives when it comes to helping those here in New Jersey that are, you know, viewed as illegal, whether it be legal representation. We know that the premise of allowing Dreamers to attend college in New Jersey at the same, let's say, tuition rates as citizens, for example. And again, I think it sort of drives it back home to sort of, you know, a very basic premise that maybe it depends on which side of the aisle you sit on, but again, you know, I'll sort of use the demographics. And again, it's not just people my parents' age. I think there are individuals of all age groups that maybe are a little more conservative on this issue and would say, hey, you know, I understand. My heart goes out to people. There are individuals that came here illegally. They brought their children with them at a very young age. Or, for example, they came here while pregnant, had their babies here on American soil, thus making them citizens under the 14th Amendment, under the naturalization clause. But some New Jerseyans, Sarah, might just try and say, hey, I understand, I do want to be compassionate, but at the end of the day, you know, citizens and residents, you know, legal residents should get more accommodations. And maybe some will try and say, hey, the idea that maybe this governor or maybe one particular political party seems to be a little more accommodating than another, it might rub them the wrong way. And, you know, I think what gets convoluted here, Sarah, is the idea that you can disagree with this, hopefully, without having a label put on you. And I think that's I think that's also making this conversation, not with you and I, because we're having a great one, as a matter of fact, but I think nationally or even statewide, Sarah, I think it makes it difficult because it's such a charged issue, it's such an emotional issue that if you even remotely sound that you're in a position of this, immediately you see the label, oh, well, that's just a racist point of view. Oh, you hate immigrants, or you're xenophobic, or you are. And I think that's a challenge, though, right? Because, you know, a lot of New Jerseyans might say, hey, I understand, I'm trying to be compassionate here, but my God, you know, I have a kid who's going to go to college. He was born here. I'm an American. Why isn't the government, why isn't the state, why isn't Governor Murphy bending over backwards for me, my son or daughter, when they're Americans? And, you know, when you hear that rhetoric, you hear that narrative, very much like the previous question I asked you. When you hear that narrative, what sort of emotions come up for you?
I mean, I think I would invite anyone who feels that the financial aid law that, you know, allows undocumented students and Dreamers, DACA recipients to get financial aid in New Jersey, you know, I'd invite them to come meet some of the young people, members of Make Through New Jersey, people who fought for this law and who are benefiting from it right now. I mean, to meet them and then to say, well, you know, this law is unfair, I think it would be pretty difficult to do that. I mean, I think, you know, they are some really amazing students. You know, the law passed on May 9th last year, just as you know, seniors were getting ready to graduate. Many of them had been admitted to college, but hadn't really known if they'd be able to pay for it. So young people in our organization really found out just at the moment when they were sort of wondering whether they'd be able to go. And now they're a year in, finishing up their first year. Some of them are going on to internships. Others have actually, you know, come back to the organization to give workshops on college access to other young people, immigrants and non-immigrants alike, first-generation college-bound students. These are young people who have grown up here, who call this country home, who've worked incredibly hard, who, you know, really just, you know, want to go to college, want to be able to work and contribute and follow their dreams like so many other young people. And I can think of no better investment that our state can make than to help people get an education. And I know that they'll give back, and I know that that it's an incredibly smart investment. So I think meeting those young people, seeing, you know, what their values are, seeing how they're putting their education to use, how they're giving back to their communities tenfold, you know, really dispels, I think, any ideas that somehow they're less deserving than someone who, you know, happened to be born here rather than, you know, moved here when they were two.
Okay, again, and the reason that I wanted to sort of, you know, put that out there is because I'm sure you hear this a lot, Sarah, and I'm sure that you hear whether we want to call them griefs or concerns from anyone really that's sort of looking to opine on the issue. It makes it challenging, right? Because as a nonprofit that Make Through New Jersey is, I mean, I think one of the components perhaps that maybe makes your job a little more difficult than it should be is the idea of having to sort of combat, whether it be inaccuracies or just combating narratives that, you know, again, may not necessarily be, you know, inappropriate or polarizing, but perhaps there are narratives that, you know, legitimate, that may be seen as legitimate by residents and anything else in New Jersey. How much of a thick skin have you developed as director of the organization and really whether, and I'm sure it's sort of a rhetorical question, but, you know, how much of a thick skin have you really developed? Because, again, it's such a polarizing issue.
I think that's right, but I mean, that's not my experience on the day-to-day. On the day-to-day, what I've seen is, especially since the Trump administration, you know, sort of launched its attacks on immigrants, has been an outpouring of support of people coming together to, you know, support, fight back, join us in the streets, join us in congressional hearings, join us to, you know, make phone calls to their legislators, join us to, you know, give a open their church to become a sanctuary. So, there has been some, you know, anti-immigrant and, you know, sentiment, I think, out there. But overall, I actually think New Jersey is a far more welcoming place and a place that, you know, 22% of our state is an immigrant, and, you know, many, like about a million people have an immigrant as a family member. So, you know, I think most people in New Jersey really, you know, have been incredibly supportive. And I will just say that I think a lot of this comes from a scarcity mindset, that if, you know, that there's a limited pie, a small pie, and that we can't all have, you know, these legal representation or access to college. And I think if you compare what it costs to put together this legal representation program, or, you know, what it costs to help someone go to college, give them financial aid, it pales in comparison to so many other things that our country is spending money on.
Well, listen, I don't disagree there, and I think that also becomes a very polarizing issue in the way that government spends money, whether it's at the state level or even federal level. But another issue, Sarah, that really is getting a lot of headlines and certainly that's creating a lot of debate and discussion in New Jersey, and I've seen a plethora of editorials on it. As a matter of fact, I think the most recent one I saw was from a guest on this program by the name of Patricia Medina Campos. I know she works for Lupe, if you're familiar, perhaps. They're another nonprofit in New Jersey, which stands for Latinas United for Political Empowerment. And Patricia is the labor leader, but she wrote a very interesting editorial about the necessity of bestowing driver's licenses to illegal immigrants in New Jersey. I know it's another policy initiative that Governor Murphy has been very adamant about. And this is where I'm a little torn on it. And I'm hoping maybe, again, this is why I've really enjoyed our dialogue tonight, because I think it's very, very informative, and I think it's also been very illuminating for our audience. But I'm sort of torn on this, because part of me is, well, you know, New Jersey is the most densely populated city in the country. People are driving. They either need to get to work, they either need to get their kids to school, they need to go food shopping, they need to drive. You know, if you live in North Jersey, for the most part, you can – I'm not sure where you live. Where I live in Hudson County, mass transit, notwithstanding the incompetence of New Jersey transit as a whole, but the accessibility of mass transit is very, very good here in Hudson County. So, I mean, I can – perhaps we live without a car, or not, so I have to drive. But here in North Jersey, so in Hudson County, having accessibility to the light rail, to the PATH train, to New Jersey Transit trains, to buses, it's very much an abundance here. As we move westward, and even south, that's not the case. So clearly, the necessity to drive is imperative. I get that. And we certainly want to make sure that drivers are insured when they're driving. The last thing you ever like to see as a motorist is being out there, and God forbid you're involved in an accident with someone that doesn't have a license, that doesn't have their car registered, and doesn't have insurance, can be catastrophic. It can be a nightmare. I think we've all read horror stories about it. So obviously it's something we want to discourage. On the flip side, it sort of, again, lends itself to the premise, and really maybe it depends on the demographic there, but some might just say, hey, you know, with doing that, you know, you might be opening up Pandora's box. You know, you're sort of rewarding people and giving them, because driving's a privilege. I mean, let's be honest, driving's a privilege, whether it's in New Jersey or the other 49 states. Driving's a privilege, not a right. I know some people might want to categorize it as that, but it's a privilege. I understand the necessity of it. I get it. But some might argue, Sarah, that, well, we're enabling, not bad behavior, but we're enabling just, you know, illegality. And when you hear these two viewpoints, how do we balance that to something that makes sense and ultimately, like anything else, something that's humane?
Well, I think first and foremost, this is a law that's about public safety. As our motor vehicles chief, Sue Fulton, often says, everyone is safer when more drivers in New Jersey are licensed, tested, and insured. And we know that there's 500,000 undocumented people in New Jersey, but there's also another 200,000 people who struggle to meet the six-point system because they don't have certain documentation. Maybe they just got married and changed their name and don't have the right birth certificate. Maybe they are a student and have moved addresses. So there are a lot of people, not just immigrants, who are struggling to meet the six-point documentation requirement, people who are recently reentering society after incarceration. And so this legislation that was proposed by Assemblywoman Quijano and Senator Joe Vitale, what it does is creates a new license called a standard license that would be open to undocumented people who are qualified to drive and can prove their identity and prove their residency, and other people as well who either can't meet the six-point requirement as is and need to provide alternative documentation. They'd still have to give 6 points, but it could be different types of documents. Or they don't want to have a real ID license, which would automatically keep their scanned copies of all of their identity documents for years and potentially share their information with a federal database. So, you know, without a doubt, what this law would do is expand access to driver's licenses. New Jersey Policy Perspective estimates it's 716,000 new drivers would be eligible for a license if this law passes. So what that means is that more people will be on the road who are licensed and insured. And it also means that, you know, it'll benefit our state. We're in a financial crisis right now in our state. And this law would generate $9 million in new license fees. It's hundreds of thousands of people driving cars, buying insurance, getting to work, buying, you know, going grocery shopping. Last week, the Hispanic Chamber of Commerce came out to endorse the law because they know that for their members, this is really about economic opportunity and making sure that everyone can consume and contribute and work in our state. So I think, you know, safety is what this is really about. You know, for our members, this is a fight that they have been involved in for years. It gets them up very early in the morning to Trenton, you know, skipping out on a day's work, you know, missing a day of pay when they make, you know, minimum wage to go lobby, to talk to their legislators, to do rallies. But it also keeps them up late at night worrying about whether they'll be able to see their kids, you know, after they drop them off from school or whether they'll be arrested for driving without a license. And as you mentioned, you know, it's about mobility. New Jersey, you know, I live in Newark. I can take the train to work in Elizabeth. A lot of people in New Jersey have to drive. Our members have to drive to pick their kids up. Some of our members take three different buses to get to work or to drop their kids off at school. So, it's a fact of life in New Jersey. You have to be able to drive. And this is such an opportunity for our state to, you know, not only recognize that immigrants, you know, contribute to our economy, are really important, are parents of U.S. citizens and should be able to drive, but also that, you know, it can help build our state's economy and make everyone safer.
Now, folks, again, if you just joined us right now, it's 9:05 here on the East Coast, and she's been an absolute sweetheart tonight with a very good interview. I know she's had a long day, and she's been great here on the program. Joining me here is the director of Make the Road New Jersey, Sarah Cullinane, here on Blog Talk Radio. It's been a great conversation. Sarah, you just raised the point now in terms of the way that the plan is enacted and how it's been proposed by the two assemblywomen, respectively. And again, it sort of brings us back to the idea that if you can't produce the 6 points that are necessary, there might be an alternative. Someone hears that, Sarah, and they might just try and say, wait a minute, I have to be inconvenienced with everything under the sun to produce 6 points when I go to the MVC to renew my license. And here is, whether it's the governor or legislators, trying to make things easier for another population. When you hear that gripe, I know you do, and when you hear that complaint, which you know, it depends again which side of the aisle you sit on ideologically. Some might view it as, hey, that's a legitimate complaint. Or some might say, well, it's a little short-sighted. Where do you sit on that?
Yes, I just really want to be clear. This is not about not having 6 points, and this is also not a special license for immigrants. This is a separate standard license that wouldn't be a real ID license. So it's open to everyone. You have to provide 6 points, but if you can't prove your citizenship, there's alternate documents that you can provide. So it's not special treatment. It's not fewer documents. It's just actually a state license that that is open to everyone, but you still have to prove all of your identity documents. It's just, you know, if you don't have your birth certificate, or you've changed your name because you got married, or because you changed your name, you've moved and you don't have your birth certificate, there's other ways of proving identity. They're very, very stringent requirements still, but they do recognize that some people just don't have the same access to documents. That includes undocumented people, but it also includes survivors of domestic violence who may have, you know, fled a home and not, you know, don't have the same access to documentation. And I do just want to say that, you know, this, yes, there are people that are, you know, opposed to this law, but we recently did polling and saw that in New Jersey, across party lines, expanding access to licenses enjoys 2-to-1 support. We've heard support several times from our Senate President, Steve Sweeney, our governor, from legislators from all over the state. And, you know, last week, I'm so glad that you mentioned Patricia Campos Medina's op-ed. She also led a group of 100 Latino leaders to send a letter to legislative leadership and the governor urging action now. So I think there's real momentum growing, and that letter was a bipartisan letter. It was a letter from Republicans and Democrats from across New Jersey, from business leaders, faith, even law enforcement as well. They, you know, when you talk to police officers, they don't want to be spending their time, you know, ticketing people for driving without a license. They want people to have a license. They want to know who's there. They want people to be insured. So I think this has, you know, this momentum is growing, and this is a really important law that we have to get done. It's incredibly important for safety, for our families, and, you know, for our economy.
Listen, I hear you. And I know that I think for all of our listeners tonight that are tuning in, I think it's been important to sort of really cover these topics, Sarah, because, you know, ultimately it's an issue that really, you know, generates conversation. It generates debate. Not just among legislators, but I think really among advocacy groups, among the media, I think among even elected officials, again, whether at the state level or the federal level. I want to get your thoughts on this. And you've been an absolute peach tonight by being on as long as you have. I know it's probably a little bit longer of an appearance than you were expecting, but it's been such a good conversation with you, Sarah. I really want to sort of maximize this as much as possible for my audience. But a topic that I know comes up a
Thank
lot.
You.
I know, no, you're more than welcome. Thank you for coming on today. A topic I know that doesn't resonate here in New Jersey, but we know on the national scene, and let's sort of get back to the national conversation for a moment. We know that in different jurisdictions, for example, I know that I believe last year the San Francisco City Council had approved an ordinance or passed an ordinance that in local school board elections, for example, they were going to permit illegal / undocumented residents to be able to vote in local school board elections. Advocacy groups in San Francisco, for example, applauded the measure. Other groups showed concerns that maybe it's trying to sort of open Pandora's box. You know, some might call it pandering. Some might call it enabling. Some might call it expanding the voter roll. Is that a legit concern, though, Sarah? I have no data to support that this is something that's going to be happening a lot nationally. But if you've ever heard that rhetoric out there, like, well, you know, what's going on in San Francisco is fair. And you know what? What's wrong with letting illegals and or undocumented people in their city, let's say, vote for, you know, school board elections? At what point in time, like, is there a cutoff you think that should be implemented? Again, listen, we know that voting's a right, but it's a right that's bestowed to citizens. So, but when you hear that narrative out there of either expanding voter rolls or expanding the right to vote, and even locally, like looking at San Francisco's model, is that something that, not necessarily maybe you agree with, but do you understand maybe how some might voice opposition and say, hey, wait a minute, we're sort of opening Pandora's box here. Like, what's going on here? This isn't right. If you've ever heard that rhetoric, what emotions is that evoking you?
Well, I can say, you know, our members have been paying very close attention to some of the local voting initiatives that have been cropping up across the country. It's really about, you know, who do you define as part of your community? If you've lived here 20 years, if you're paying taxes, if your kids are in school. I mean, I look at the Elizabeth Public Schools, I look at Passaic Public Schools, you know, the cities that we're in across the state where we, you know, where we have offices, where we have, where we're organizing and doing work. And there's just, you know, in any other place you'd call it mass disenfranchisement. There are so many people who are part of the school, students, parents, who don't have a voice on in terms of who's serving, who's representing them. So this is really just about how, you know, how do you define what it means to belong to a community? And of course, like how did our country start, right? A fight over no taxation without representation. We see undocumented people and green card holders, non-citizens, permanent residents, people who are in every sense contributing to the community, to the economy, are invested. Our members are out there. Some of them may not be able to vote, but they're out knocking on doors, registering voters. Mm-hmm. Last year, we talked to 13,000 registered voters to remind them to come out to vote. So, you know, who wants to tell them that they shouldn't be able to have a voice in what goes on in their school district? So I think those initiatives are incredibly important. I hope we can see some here in New Jersey. And I think that it's in cities that you can really, that you're seeing experimentation about, you know, how we're defining who belongs. And I think it's inspiring, and I don't know, we'll see where it takes us.
All right. Well, based on your answer, and I understand, listening, your answer sounds very commonsensical, and it sounds very, I think, pragmatic. But Sarah, but you understand where some of the outrage comes from, right? Like, I mean, the idea that, you know, we want to keep voting to citizens, like, I don't think that's wrong. Like, we'll have these conversations with activists or other people from other organizations. You know, again, sometimes it's hard, right? Because it gets emotional, and we start getting reactions from people like, well, what do you have to hide, and why are you being discriminatory? Sarah, I don't know. I don't believe I'm discriminatory. I just sort of have this premise that the right to vote is sacred, and it's afforded to citizens. And I don't think we're different than any other sort of industrialized country in the world. I think if you go across the Atlantic, you know, listen, ideologically, and I hear this all the time, especially in academia, where I hear a lot of my fellow academics talk about, well, you know, we emulate certain things in Europe. It's kind of funny when, you know, when people sometimes want to pick and choose what to emulate from Europe, right? It's an economic system or government. I always find it funny. It's like, it's very convenient what we should emulate in European countries and whether or not we should introduce them here. Sarah, but it's not any different in Latin America. I know, for example, in Colombia, where my father's from, I mean, if you're a citizen, you get to vote. If you're not a citizen, you don't get the right to vote. It's sort of like very sort of embedded within the society. I think very much like it is across the Atlantic in countries in Europe, and I think even in North America and Latin America, Sarah. This is just me. I don't think it's unreasonable to sort of just keep that right sacred and just say it's bestowed to citizens. I don't think we're any different than any other civilized country in the world. But it seems that if I espouse that sort of rhetoric, here comes the backlash. Oh, Fernando, oh my God, Fernando, well, you're discriminatory. Why do you have to hide? Believe me, I've heard this. I've heard this in academic circles. I've heard this at cocktail parties. And it's sort of frustrating. Like, I hope you know where I'm coming from, right?
And I think that you make a really important point, and it's not something that should be taken lightly. I think you know, I think if you look at cities and specifically we're looking at school boards, I think these are experiments that are happening, and it's really a response to, you know, what we talked about earlier, our federal immigration system, which is broken, which has left 11 million people here without status, who've been trying to, you know, there's just no way to get to having status, and there's just limited opportunity to get citizenship. So this is one experimentation to make sure that everyone is represented. You know, all kids have the right to go to school in this country regardless of status. Our Supreme Court has ruled on that, and, you know, so why shouldn't all parents then have the right to vote? So I think, you know, there are experiments that come out of, that are happening at the local level that come from just stagnation in our federal policy. In an ideal world where we, you know, had an immigration system that worked, that allowed people to adjust status, get citizenship in a way that made sense, you know, it may not be necessary, but I think that, you know, where you're seeing non-citizen voting in local elections and school board elections, what you're seeing is just increased democracy and more participation. And, you know, I really don't think that can hurt. So, but they're really important debates to have and, you know, really just fundamental questions that we have to ask.
I mean, just to be clear, I mean, in the sense of, you know, it's a compelling argument because of the local level issues, and I hear where you're coming from on that. But just to be clear, I mean, sort of the sanctity of voting at anything beyond that, should that still remain the same, whether we're talking about a congressional seat, a U.S. Senate seat, or ultimately voting for president? I mean, is that something that you would want to see expanded, or do you feel that the cutoff line is really at the local level?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. I think that, you know, I'd be interested in seeing more how it works out at the local level, and how, you know, what it means for how these school districts work, how parents and families are interacting with the schools. I think that's, you know, that's the question to ask now, and then to go from there. But I don't think that those initiatives are, you know, they're not happening at the federal level right now. They're not happening, you know, in general elections and state elections even. Yeah.
Well, speaking of federal elections, and just a couple more things before I let you go, you've been a great guest tonight. You know, looking at sort of the mission statement and really some of the fundamental principles that define Mantaroa, New Jersey, I know at the onset of the program you expressed legitimate concerns about the current political climate at the federal level. Certainly, you've been very, very transparent in terms of your disagreements with the president. But, you know, coming up next year, it's 2020, it's election season. We're going to be looking to see at who will challenge the president next November. And as you can see now, there's almost a Major League Baseball-sized roster of candidates from the Democratic Party right now that are challenging. I mean, it's growing by day. I mean, it pretty much will come to the point where it'll be over 25 people maybe. But Sarah, on a national level, and I was discussing this yesterday with a guest on my local podcast in Hudson County, you know, going into next year, and I could tell from the onset, certainly you vehemently have severe disagreements with the president, and certainly not a good perception of the president. But, you know, in totality, when, you know, and don't worry, I'm not going to ask you to pick a favorite here, who you like, you know, who's your candidate. I'm not going to put you in the spot. Don't worry. I mean, unless you want to volunteer that, that's up to you, but I'm not going to ask you that. But if we look at sort of the following dynamics, and, you know, we see that on a whole, you know, listen, I'll be the first one to tell you, and I have no reason to lie to you. You can archive past episodes here. I've been the first one on this program, and really the only one, I think, on Insider NJ that really takes the stands of, you know, I vehemently often have issues with the president. I think that in many instances, the president lacks decorum. I feel that in many instances, the president lacks civility. I think in many instances, the president lacks the capacity to be presidential. And I think, and those are, for some people, those are fundamentally very important traits that you want in the commander in chief and the executive of the country. But Sarah, on a national level though, going into next year, you know, short of some sort of you know, economic catastrophe, right now we're looking at job growth remaining very strong. We're seeing unemployment rates for women at all-time lows. We're seeing unemployment rates for people of color, both black and brown. They're also quite low for the, probably we haven't seen rates like this in more than maybe 10 to 12 years. We're seeing job creation in various sectors of the country. We're seeing even the approval rating among blacks and also Latinos for the president much higher than other Republicans during this point in their presidency. Short of maybe a middle-of-the-road Democrat coming along the way and maybe challenging the president. But in terms of what he has going for him right now, I would make the argument he's going to be very tough to beat, especially if the other side is perhaps propping up someone who's very liberal or radically liberal, where instead maybe a more moderate candidate can make the president vulnerable. Am I wrong in my analysis here?
I think you're right. It's going to be a big fight, and I don't think anyone should underestimate how hard we all will have to work to get Trump out of the office. I mean, I think New Jersey, though, like for me this past year, New Jersey has been an example, flipping so many of the congressional seats here. You know, on our C4, we were involved in several of the races, knocking on doors, getting out the vote. And I think we saw that there is serious outrage. And when you have candidates that can speak to that outrage, when you have candidates that, you know, I think can also speak to the, you know, issues of economic insecurity, and, you know, how to build an economy that works for everyone, that, you know, we can succeed. And I'll just, you know, on a positive note, in New Jersey, like, you know, last year, there were the, you know, all the Republican congressional seats that flipped. You know, this year, just last month, actually, a new DREAM Act, and called the Dream and Promise Act, which would give a pathway to citizenship to Dreamers and TPS holders, was introduced. And every single new Democrat and former Democrat in New Jersey, you know, incumbent, supported that legislation. So, you know, I think there is a way in which the Trump administration has created such a polarized universe and has, you know, just in terms of speaking on immigrant rights, has really pushed the line and made such horrendous attacks on families that we're really seeing people step up and support pathways to citizenship, comprehensive legislation that, you know, just 2 years ago, not all Democrats were signing on to. So I see that as a sign of progress. I think the fact that we can both bring on new Democrats, flip seats, but also hold them accountable to, you know, the progressive base that helped elect them is an important sign. And I'm not sure. I don't think, you know, as New Jersey goes, does not necessarily go the rest of the country at all. It, you know, there are some lessons to be drawn.
I mean, the reason I brought that up, though, Sarah, is, and listen, I think that, as you mentioned, that, you know, what happened in New Jersey, for example, in flipping so many House seats, I think that, again, whether that was an anomaly or just sort of a representation of the fact that maybe the political climate was contributing to that. But you do see, I mean, I'm hopeful, at least from my perspective, hopefully you see this, that whether it's Governor Murphy's narrative or some of the narratives you heard from congressional candidates here in New Jersey. I mean, it's one thing in New York and New Jersey and California, right, Sarah? The idea of maybe, let's say, one party, the Democratic Party, as we're seeing in a large segment, is moving very hard to the left, right, perhaps, and that's how it's being perceived. I mean, it could be very difficult to win over middle-of-the-road people. I mean, again, this is for me in California, New Jersey, and New York. But what do you know about people in Ohio and Pennsylvania and Wisconsin and Michigan and Florida? That might be a tall order, right, in the sense of, you know, you can be a Democrat, you can be a liberal, you can be progressive, but we're not seeing some of those. We're seeing people that are very far left. And is that really a winning formula going into next year? I mean, it's still a ways away. But concisely, is that a winning formula? I would argue no. I would argue that a more moderate type of individual makes the president vulnerable. But I'm not seeing that. Do you see it that way, too?
I mean, I think we tried more moderate last time around. It didn't work so well. I mean, I think, you know, without a doubt, a candidate that is only running on an anti-Trump platform is not going to win. We need someone that will speak to shared values. We need someone who will speak to a vision of what our country can be, a more inclusive economy, a stronger economy, and a country that isn't premised on hateful values that our president is espousing. So I think, you know, building that there is a pathway to winning. I think it's going to take a lot of hard work. It's going to take a lot of, like grassroots activism, as we saw, you know, here in New Jersey. But I don't think that moving to the center is the solution. I think the Democratic Party has tried that, and I don't see that as the way forward in 2020.
Okay, fair enough. You know, fair enough. Sarah, before I let you go, you've been A, an absolute sweetheart. B, what I like to do for every guest of mine on this program, and again, I'll let my listeners decide. In terms of what we've heard today, I think you've been very illuminating. I think you've been very informative. And again, we let the audience decide in terms of, how they view the issues we've discussed today. What I do like to do, folks, every time I have a guest on, every week or every day when we commute to work, Sarah, people are going to Dunkin' Donuts or, Starbucks or Quick Trip and 7-Eleven or even Wawa's throughout New Jersey. What I ask you tonight to do is, if you're going every day on your way to work to get a coffee, instead of doing it 5 days a week, do me a favor. Do it 3 days a week and take those 2 days, add them up at the end of the month, and do me a favor. Go to www.maketheroadnj.org. Right at the very top is the donate button. So what you're saving by not buying coffee, take the amount, and if you wish to support Make the Road New Jersey, and that's your prerogative if you want, do me a favor. Go on the website, www.maketheroadnj.org. Click the donate button, and like I said, two less coffees a week won't kill you. Really, 8 coffees less a month won't kill you. And if you want to take that disposable income and donate it to them, feel free. I encourage you to do so. You like that plug tonight, Sarah? How's that? Probably caught you by surprise.
That was the best plug I've heard. Thank you. We should hire you to be our fundraising consultant. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
I really appreciate the opportunity to be on. And, thanks for all your questions.
No, listen, you've been great. And before I let you go, I know what I like to do for my guests is give you the floor real quick. If you have a question for me, or if you want to pick my brain, Sarah, about something, the floor is yours. If you wish to sort of, interview me now or something, if something's on your mind, the floor is yours. What do you got?
Oh, thanks so much. I guess I'm curious to hear if thinking about your you spoke a lot about your parents, really movingly about your parents, and thinking about some of the issues that we've talked about today. I mean, what do you think? Thinking about the driver's license issue, how would you talk with them about it, and what do you think their views would be on it?
Well, I think first and foremost, I think the biggest challenge I would face for anybody in my age demographic, talking to my parents or anyone really within that age demographic, is I think there's a very big generational disconnect, Sarah, that exists. As you alluded to at the onset of the program, clearly the laws and the parameters in which my parents immigrated here under were very different 50 years ago than, let's say, present day or even the last 10 years. So I'm aware of that. I would argue that my parents and those in their age brackets would also acknowledge that as well. I think at the end of the day, it comes down to trying to sort of just explain the issues. Because again, as I mentioned, my parents are very humane and they look at these issues very compassionately, but I don't want to use the term old school, but they're also sort of the belief. And listen, again, and one of the things about, Latin America, especially older Latin Americans, is that they tend to be very conservative. And I think they tend to be very conservative, not just on economic issues, but they tend to be conservative on social issues or when it comes to issues about legality and, law enforcement, things of that nature. I think there's a very big disconnect that exists trying to convince them, like, hey, whether it's your organization, Sarah, and I've had other organizations as well on this program that have talked about these issues, it's a hard sell. It really can be. And I think because of, you know, just, again, the generational gap that exists ideologically, I think it's probably the biggest obstacle that I would face or anybody would face having to have these conversations. Because it's hard to sort of convince them otherwise and say, well, you know, the political climate for many years has been very polarizing. And, you know, we know that immigration has been weaponized. I think that's a term that we probably haven't used a lot tonight, if at all. But it's become weaponized. And because it's become weaponized, I think that it creates very hard lines in the sand. And I think that's the challenge that I would face or anybody would face in talking to someone like my parents or anybody in that age bracket. Because, again, there's a certain type of conservatism that is very prevalent ideologically. And I think trying to get past that is probably the biggest challenge. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, definitely. Definitely.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you for that.
No, listen, you're welcome. And, again, I want to thank you again, Sarah. And, you know, keep up the good work. I certainly look forward to having you on later, you know, later in the spring or summer just to get an update for what Make the Room New Jersey is doing. Any updates or any events coming up that our listeners should know about tonight?
Sure. So on Thursday night, we're having a workshop for young people who want to learn how to apply for financial aid under the new law. And we are going to be holding a rally on April 22nd, the day before the Supreme Court will decide the census, the citizenship question on the census in Passaic. And you can find out more information if you follow us on Twitter or on Facebook at Make the Road NJ or Instagram. That's at Make the Road NJ.
Okay. Well, again, Sarah, thank you for your time. You've been an absolute sweetheart. I know you've been on longer than you would have liked, but I felt that this episode would be extremely important for our listeners tonight to really get to the heart of a lot of issues that are on the minds of New Jersey residents. So thank you. Have a wonderful Easter. Have a great spring. And we'll talk to you again soon here on Politically Direct.
Thank you so much, Fernando. You too. Take care.
Have a good one. All right, folks, here at 9:30 on the East Coast here on Blog Talk Radio. And a wonderful episode tonight with the director of Make the Road New Jersey, Ms. Sarah Cullinane, here on Blog Talk Radio. Really, folks, it's just an amazing episode here tonight, I think. And I'll sort of go on the record here tonight. This is probably one of my better episodes. I hope my boss, who's celebrating her birthday today, is listening to that. But I think this has been one of my better episodes, folks. I think this was an episode I was very much looking forward to because I really wanted to get to the heart of the matter of what's making the topic of immigration reform so polarizing for residents. And I think that overall, we accomplished that today here on Blog Talk Radio. So, folks, again, if you missed any part of tonight's broadcast, you can always tune in to www.insidernj.com/podcast. You can also check it out at www.blogtalkradio.com/politicallydirectnj. You can download the episode from either site, again, www.insidernj.com/podcast, that's plural, or www.blogtalkradio.com/politicallydirectnj. You can listen to the episode in its entirety tonight from any PC, Mac, smartphone, or tablet. You can be able to listen to it in its entirety at the top of the hour here, as it will be available online. You can download it, listen to it whenever you want, and I certainly welcome your feedback here. And folks, again, don't forget that every Thursday live at 8 p.m., you can listen to the best analysis and commentary about everything going on in New Jersey, and it's always right here on Politically Direct. Now, if you have a topic or issue you want to hear about next week, please write to the show, folks, politicallydirectnj@yahoo.com. Don't forget to follow the show on Instagram at politicallydirectnj. You can also follow me on Instagram personally at Professor Fernando Uribe. Also, check me out on Twitter at Professor Uribe. And, of course, don't forget to like Politically Direct on Facebook. Tell your friends to do the same. Share it on your walls and ask them to do it too. Folks, again, don't forget to check out www.insidernj.com every single day in various parts throughout the day, folks. The best coverage of the political scene throughout the state of New Jersey. Just outstanding journalists. Wonderful columnists that we have here. Again, I want to send a shout out to my teammates, Insider NJ. It starts at the very top with the editor-in-chief, Max Pizarro. Certainly my boss, Pete Meglia. celebrating his birthday today. So God bless you, Pete. Happy birthday. You're a great boss to work for. And thanks for tolerating me, because I know I can be a pain in the ass from time to time. So appreciate it. And but folks, again, once you go on the website, www.centernj.com, at the very top, click on the subscribe button. And once you do, you'll be enrolled in the morning intelligence briefing, conveniently delivered to your inbox each and every morning. So whether you're watching cable news shows or the sports debate shows, hey, I know you're scrolling through your smartphone or your tablet or your PC or Mac. You're checking your inbox. You'll see the morning intelligence briefing there with all the best news and the coverage of everything going on in the Garden State. It's always courtesy, again, by going to www.insidernj.com. Don't forget to start your day and end your day with Insider NJ. All right, folks, again, if you missed any part of tonight's broadcast, www.insidernj.com/podcasts. Also, www.blogtalkradio.com/politicallydirectNJ. And, folks, whether it's on your morning commute, you're getting your daily workout in, walking your dog, doing laundry, your homework, take a minute, tune in, and you'll be happy that you did. And it is real. It is here. It is always politically direct. Good night, Elizabeth. Central Jersey representing there in Union County, all my listeners tonight tuning in down in Elizabeth. Appreciate it. There's always a great Colombian festival every July to commemorate Colombian independence on July 20th. It's not to miss, folks, a tremendous festival in Elizabeth down there. You definitely don't want to miss out. So shout out to all my people down there in Elizabeth. So, folks, have a great weekend. Please party responsibly, and I'll see you next week here on Blog Talk Radio. And don't forget, let's keep on talking. Oh, ain't you still?